Thanks to Michael and Scott for organizing this symposium, and thanks for everybody for being here today. I'm going to talk about the thermal TDR sensor. And thermal TDR sensor is combining two other sensors. It combines a heat pulse probe and a TDR probe. And it can be used to measure a variety of soil properties and what we call processes or fluxes. First thing I want to remind you is that heat and water movement in soil is coupled, particularly near the soil surface. This particular graph, this particular figure, is taken from the literature from Jackson, and they irrigated a bare field and then monitored the transient water content near the surface over several days. You can see the trend is drying, but there's a diurnal variation in the water content, strong diurnal variation. In the daytime, it dries, in the nighttime, it re-wets. And there's also a diurnal variation in soil temperature. These things are coupled. When water moves in soil, it carries heat. When you have a thermal gradient, water moves in soil. Models are useful and very helpful, but to use a model at a particular location, you need hydraulic properties and thermal properties and boundary conditions. So measurements are essential on studying heat-water movement, especially near the surface. So first we'll start with the TDR sensor. The TDR sensor is a waveguide that we can put into the soil. It's connected to a cable tester, and a signal, electrical signal, is put forth. It goes down the waveguide, reflects back up, and we can determine a travel time of that signal. The travel time can be used to calculate the apparent dielectric constant. And Top et al. In 1980 had an empirical equation that you can use the apparent dielectric constant to estimate the water content. And if you want to do it on a particular soil, you can develop your own equation for that. For a heat pulse sensor, we need two needles. One would be a heater wire, and the other one a sensor. So an electrical signal, a pulse, is given, and the electrical energy is converted to thermal energy, increasing the temperature. And then the temperature change with time is monitored. So you get this kind of a curve right here from the pulse. And if we focus on just the maximum value, maximum temperature change, we can have two explicit equations, one for thermal diffusivity and one for heat capacity, or you can fit a model to the whole curve. Early work on this was by Galen Campbell, Gerard Klutenberg, and Keith Bristow. And actually, I learned about the heat pulse method from Keith Bristow. He was a visiting scientist at Iowa State in 1992. That's when I got started on it. So we combined these together, the TDR and the heat pulse sensor, into a single sensor. In this case, it's got three needles here. One has a heater element, and then temperature sensors, so we can do the heat pulse method with that. And then we connect them to a coaxial cable that would be connected to a cable tester, so we can use a TDR measurement. So the same sensor measures electrical properties and thermal properties on basically the same volume of soil. And that's a photo of one next door to it, to the diagram. And it's a small sensor. It's about 1 centimeter across and 4 centimeters in length. And I was blessed with two really smart postdocs in the 1990s, Tusheng Ren and Kosuke Noborio, and they worked on this particular sensor. Noborio had the idea for this sensor, and Dr. Ren worked on a good design for it. And so we had that paper published back then. Some of the results that we got, we could see we could measure soil temperature, soil water content, soil thermal properties, thermal conductivity, thermal diffusivity, volumetric heat capacity, and we could also measure bulk electrical conductivity, which I won't talk about much today. Then right after that, I was blessed with a really insightful graduate student. A young Tyson Auctioner told me that if we can measure the volumetric heat capacity, and it depends on water content and bulk density, and with the heat pulse probe, and if the TDR can measure the water content, we just have one unknown from the heat capacity, bulk density. He said he thinks he could do it. My as the professor, I said, do it. So he did. And so he used this particular equation for bulk density, and he showed in laboratory measurements that he could determine water content and bulk density with the thermal TDR sensor, giving us a sensor with the possibility to monitor these things transient, temperature, water content, bulk density in the field situation. He also measured the volume fraction of solids, the gas volume fraction, and degree of saturation. One of Dr. Ren's graduate students, Liu, did a field experiment where she tilled the soil and she inserted thermal TDR sensors and also took soil cores. Now she took the soil cores after the tillage when it would have a rainfall, so a wetting and then a drying cycle. Then after every one of those, she would take a soil core and there'd be settling increase of the bulk density with time. And on those two graphs, those are two different fields. The diamond, blue diamonds are the thermal TDR measurements of bulk density with time, and the pink squares are the soil cores. I think both can capture. So again, we can have an ability to monitor transient bulk density in the field. Ely Liu, a former student of Dr. Ren, had the idea that maybe she could use thermal conductivity measurements to also get the bulk density. She developed an equation for thermal conductivity as a function of water content and bulk density. So using the heat pulse method, she could get the thermal conductivity with the TDR, the water content, so it's one unknown. Also, she could get the bulk density. So she did some comparisons. The triangles are representative of estimated bulk density with thermal TDR on the y-axis. The x-axis are soil cores, gravimetric bulk density. And you can see that the triangles have a little bit more scatter and not as accurate as the red circles. The red circles are from thermal conductivity-based estimate, and the triangles are from heat capacity-based estimate. And the main problem with the heat capacity-based estimate is it's really sensitive to the spacing of the needles. So if you calibrate the sensor in the laboratory, get the spacing, but push it into the soil or, you know, transient bulk density, change that spacing, then your determination of heat capacity is inaccurate, so your estimate of bulk density is not as accurate. A spacing change does not have much effect on the thermal conductivity, though, so it may be more stable as a method. On Wednesday, Ely Liu is going to present a poster showing how to get bulk density and water content with a heat pulse sensor. This thing about the needle deflection has been a big deal, you know, that has a big impact on heat pulse accuracy. And I know some scientists. One is Gang Liu from China. We've brainstormed what to do about this problem, and we have come up with a trigonometric correction so that if we calibrate the sensor ahead of time in the laboratory, put it into the soil, in situ, we're able to calculate any change in the spacing and then do a correction of that change to get the thermal properties. I don't have time to show all the equations on that, but tomorrow on the, I call the lightning oral, there's a grad student, Wen, that's going to talk about that method, and she has a poster tomorrow talking about how to correct the spacing on heat pulse or thermal TDR sensors. Okay, let's go to processes. You can use a heat pulse probe to measure soil heat flux, and it's really simple and straightforward. If you put in the heat pulse sensor or thermal TDR sensor this way, then you can measure ambient temperature and estimate a gradient. Then do a heat pulse, estimate the thermal conductivity, and just Fourier's equation, thermal conductivity times gradient, will give you the soil heat flux. Early papers on that, Kobos and Baker, Auctioner, Tom Sauer, and then recently, this year, Pung did some studies, and these are just showing the top graph is net radiation for several days. The middle graph shows the solid curve is the soil heat flux at a depth of 5 centimeters with the heat pulse probe. And then the dashed curve would represent the change in heat storage of the 0 to 5 centimeter layer above that. And then sum those together will give you the soil heat flux at the surface down below. He did it at 5 centimeters because he had a soil heat flux plate there and wanted to compare it. And if he had very good results. I'm not showing that data right now. But the idea for the heat pulse probe is you don't have some of the problems that you have with the plate on blocking mass movement, so you can bring it closer to the surface to get soil heat flux closer to the surface. Okay, the next topic is evaporation of water. A former student, Heitman, a co-author on this paper, had the idea that you can do a sensible heat balance in order to determine the latent heat for a layer of soil or as a function of depth in the profile. And basically, you measure the sensible heat into a layer, sensible heat out of the layer, like this thing's not working too good, and then a change of storage of sensible heat. Let's just focus on this equation. Heat in, heat out, change of storage. If those sum to zero, then there's no missing heat. There's no latent heat. If they don't sum to zero, then there's some latent heat involved. And if it's above freezing temperature, could be evaporation, a sink for heat, or condensation, a source. And if it's below zero, could be ice formation or ice melting in that situation. So we can use a single heat pulse probe in order to determine evaporation or latent heat for a layer. Look at this, we'll put the probes this way. And so we have temperature, ambient temperature at three depths, T1, T2, T3. Once we have that temperature, we'll do a heat pulse, measure the thermal properties, thermal conductivity, and heat capacity. Then we'll estimate the gradient times the thermal conductivity to get heat flux one into a layer, heat flux two out of the layer. And then with the heat capacity, we can get the change of storage over a window of time as the temperature changed. We sum those up and get latent heat. So we can get the latent heat, again, for evaporation in this case. So we built a sensor with many needles, and this was published by student Zhang. It's also been used by Xinhua Shao in bare fields and crop fields. And what happens is you can get the latent heat for different layers from the surface down. So you can figure out evaporation as a function of depth and time with this particular sensor. So here's some data that was published by Zhang. These are the temperature variations on a millimeter scale. And the whole method works because all we measure is temperature. We don't have any other measurements. It's only temperature-based measurement. And we can usually do that quite accurately. So we measure ambient temperature. Then with the heat pulse, we can get heat capacity with depth and time, thermal conductivity with depth and time, and then use the simple equation to calculate evaporation. So this first curve is closer to the surface at a shallow depth. As it dries out, it starts getting evaporation deeper. And then as it dries out, that was the red, now the green is deeper. You get evaporation deeper. So you can follow evaporation from the surface down with this particular technique. If you integrate the evaporation in the profile, you can get a daily, with depth and time, you can get a daily evaporation. On the y-axis is the heat pulse daily evaporation. On the x-axis was microlysimeter change of mass or a Bowen ratio that was integrated over the day. And we got good agreement with the heat pulse and those methods for a bare field. Okay, the next topic we can use this for is to measure water flow in soil, liquid water flow. This shows a heat pulse sensor and those little arrows showing some water down, J of water flux. So let's say there's no water flux. We give a heat pulse, then the upstream needle and the downstream needle should be equal. It's just conduction heat transfer carrying the heat. So those would have the same temperature with time. But if there's water flow down, let's say, upstream will be smaller, increase of temperature, downstream larger, because you have convection carrying some heat downward with it. The difference in those upstream, downstream will be related to the soil water flux. Greater the difference, the greater the soil water flux in that particular case. We had a postdoc, Wong, and Auctioner came up with a really simple equation to describe this relationship. They found that the soil water flux is proportional to the natural log of the ratio of the downstream temperature to the upstream temperature. Dr. Ren had a student that did some tests in China in laboratory columns where they could measure the actual water flux here on the x-axis and the water flux derived from that equation I just showed you. And they found good one-to-one relationship on saturated flow. Now, there's been a lot of other people work on this topic. Scott Jones, his group, Kamai, Hopman's, Klutenberg, Auctioner, a lot of other papers have been published on this. And to my knowledge right now, the measurements can go as low as about 10 to the minus 6 meters per second, which is a few millimeters per hour as the lowest flow. Okay, now we've been doing some work on measuring unsaturated water fluxes in the soil also. And unsaturated water fluxes, the way we do it is we have two different steps. The first step is to do the sensible heat balance with the heat pulse probe to determine the evaporation term for a layer of soil. Then with that evaporation term, we plug it into the water balance equation. And the water balance equation, we can use TDR to get the change of water content over a time step. We know the evaporation over that time step. So what's left unknown is the net flux for that particular layer. Imagine this is the surface, a drier surface, where the liquid water flux is zero to the surface. So we can just solve, we know that term by measurement, TDR, that term by heat pulse, one of these is zero, so we get the liquid water flux at the bottom. If we stack these layer by layer, we can get liquid water flux with depth and time under evaporation conditions. We have some data. I'm not going to show it to you now because tomorrow Dr. Tian is going to give an oral presentation where he's going to show you the data of determining liquid water flux. And he also he measured water potential. So by measuring liquid water flux and water potential, in situ can measure unsaturated hydraulic conductivity. So if you're interested in that, I invite you back for tomorrow for Dr. Tian. My last topic is ice content. So if we do the sensible heat balance method, flux in, flux out, change of storage, and it's below zero, then any other heat is going to be ice forming or ice melting. So we had a student, Kojima, that did proof of concept with synthetic data using the Shaw model, and he saw that these little simple equations for sensible heat balance, those are all the little dots, what do you call this, the broken curves on there, they're at different depths. Each one of those segments is different depth and time. He found that by imposing temperature of heating in the daytime, cooling at night, so freezing at night, thawing in the daytime kind of thing, he found that he could get very similar results of ice content with depth and time, proof of concept. Then he did some experiments, and he found that the sensible heat balance works well when it just starts to freeze, because it's a large latent heat, and when it thaws, it's a large latent heat. So when it's temperatures between 0 and negative 3 degrees, but other temperatures below negative 3 degrees, it's so small that he can't really measure it accurately. So it gives the sensible heat balance, gives some shape like this for ice content. But he found, as well as confirmed by Dr. Tian, you can measure change of heat capacity on temperatures below that negative 3 to get change of ice content in that sense. I think there's more work to do on the ice stuff, okay, but we've made some progress. Summary, thermal TDR can measure temperature, water content, bulk electrical conductivity, thermal properties, and bulk density. There's some variables like thermal conductivity, water content, bulk density that need to be explored in the field, maybe even permittivity and electroconductivity and thermal conductivity. Those haven't been done yet. They need to be explored. And you can determine heat flux, evaporation, and water flow. Again, I'll mention tomorrow, Tian's going to talk about liquid water flow in soil. Wen's going to talk about correcting the needles, and Lou's going to talk about water content and bulk density. And then a quick promo, Josh Heitman in June 2018 is going to have host a workshop on construction theory application of thermal TDR sensors. If you want to learn more about that, come or send students to North Carolina then. Thank you so much.
We have time for a question.
Yes, sir.
When you do the heat budget analysis of the heat points in and out, does that get messed up when you have plant roots growing in there?
I don't think so much the plant roots. The plant roots, if they're dynamic, changing, they might change the heat capacity a little bit. And if they take up water, it can change the heat capacity. But the main point is that if you're having change of phase for a little bit of water, there's a lot more heat involved than a little bit of movement of liquid water in or out. So I don't think it's a big problem. Thank you for your question.
Thank you.